Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. According to my guest today, there are two types of children, easy and not so easy. As he writes, the not so easy child requires more energy, focus, and special parenting skills. You are tired because you have a not so easy child. One size parenting does not fit the not so easy child. You need extra understanding and tools to build new skills. Parents call not-so-easy children words like difficult, defiant, or spoiled, but that's not usually the case. In his new book, The Normal But Not-So-Easy Child, pediatrician Dr. Robert Hudson explains that behavior, which is so often the focus of parents and teachers, is really much more a manifestation of a child's temperament. And parenting success can rely on a better understanding of your child's temperament and how they respond according to it. Tantrums, which all kids have at some point, are also called meltdowns, which we frequently ascribe to a child not getting what he or she wants. But really, a meltdown is caused by not understanding how a child is hardwired and adjusting our parenting expectations accordingly. Bob Hudson was trained as a general pediatrician before turning to consulting and medical management. In 2002, he returned to practice at the University of Oklahoma, specializing in helping parents understand their not-so-easy children who were labeled difficult or as having behavioral problems in school. He retired last year and wrote his new book, The Normal But Not-So-Easy Child, Raising Your Child Without Frustration, Anger, or Guilt. Dr. Robert Hudson is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Bob Hudson, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start by having you take us through what you mean by the not-so-easy child. What are you referring to there?
I'm referring to what I call a not-so-easy child. They've been referred to by parents as high-spirited, high-maintenance, hyperactive, demanding, difficult, strong-willed, spoiled, behavioral challenged, temperamental, troubled. But all of those terms, particularly, say, difficult, demanding, you know, defiant, they all imply that the child is doing this on purpose. There is intent to the behavior. And what we now know in neuroscience is behavior in the first 10 years is really not intentful. If you're talking about a teenager, all bets are off. But but the younger child is programmed from birth. Your brain starts working before you're born. And you're born with a genetic imprint of how the brain's going to respond to the environment and what your first response will be. This is not intentful. You can measure the temperament traits at 3 months. They're stable at 18 months, and they are there throughout your life that way, unless you modify them. You learn to manage them, but they're there.
You mentioned a word there that I think is very important and obviously one of the keys to your book and to your method, which is temperament. And we tend, for reasons I'm not sure I understand, but I guess if any of us that are parents think about it, how does our kid or how do our kids behave? And so behavior becomes the focus. And what you've taught me through conversations and this book is really it's less about behavior. Behavior is more of an output. And temperament is really the native state, if you will.
It's the temperament traits are the components of how your brain functions. And so if it's not intentional, you know, if you look at children just as children, some are easy and some are not easy. So I just came up with the term not so easy or easy. About 40% are easy. Another 20% are easy sometimes and not so easy sometimes. And then there's another 40% that are not easy.
So in the not so easy, and for parents out there, you're talking about children. Where would, in this spectrum, would autism or other kinds of difficult emotional or students needing independent educational plans, where would they fall?
I think anything that causes the parent to pause is not so easy. And the amplitude of that not so easy is important, too. Is it 3 or 4 or 5 times a month? Is it 3 or 4 times a week? Is it 3 or 4 times a day? Is it 3 or 4 times an hour? And this is something that in medicine, you either have a strep throat or you don't have a strep throat. In the mental health pieces of children, there is an amplitude there. It's a little bit more, A lot? A whole lot more. Oh, whoa, boy, is this child a challenge.
And so eventually you developed this referral practice for kids on this temperament spectrum. But I wanted to ask you about a few terms that you use in the book. So one is a term I really wasn't that familiar with, but you call it lockup. It's like where the kid just gets locked up. And what you describe is kind of a brain, it leads into a meltdown. And everyone knows what a meltdown is. We see this out in public in the shopping mall or at the restaurant when the kid misbehaves. And we probably as parents or as just people, we all have our judgments. And you write about this, where some people are kind of, if you want to call them old-fashioned, and they say, well, that kid needs discipline.
Right.
And other parents say, hey, you know, you got to let the kid just scream it out or whatever. But right. You have a pretty tried-and-true method for kind of avoiding these types of things by trying to teach parents to be more anticipatory. So take us through a little bit about how that framework works.
If a child... Really, behavior is how you respond to the environment. And children that misbehave, really, all that is a problem these children are having that they can't solve. It's just that simple. So misbehavior is an unsolved problem. If you push these children, it gets worse. So how can you tell if a child is not solving the problem? So I said, well, let's call it a lockup. And a lockup is a pouty face, crossed arms, looking down, have a scowl on the face. Well, something's wrong. They can't solve the problem. Your brain is still engaged, but if you push, say a child is watching television, and this child is non-adaptive. That's one of the temperament traits. And they don't do well with change. And so you yell in, come to dinner, and this child melts down, has a fit. Well, he's just intentionally doing this to get under my skin because he had to stop watching. He's spoiled. It has nothing to do with that. His brain was engaged watching television, and you just changed the expectation for his brain for him. His transition time is slower. These children's transition time's slower, so they have to be warned there's a change coming. So if you just spring it on them, they go from locked up to melting down, because the next phrase out of your mouth when they don't come right away is, do it now. That's a taser word. You just tased his brain. When you get angry, you lose about 50 IQ points. Most people can't solve a problem down 50 IQ points. So if you can hold them in lockup before they melt down, then you've got a chance to change the outcome. If you push, they begin to melt down. If then you try to stop the meltdown, you're just crawling in the mud hole with them.
Right, and this mud hole is a fabulous metaphor in the book, which is we're all going to get muddy in that mud hole. And that's what happens.
Nothing good happens when you crawl into the mud hole.
When we, the parents, are angry and the kid has melted down, and we're all stuck in the mud hole, it feels virtually impossible to get out of. And once we finally do get out of, we're all just the worse for wear and totally muddy and have to, you know, wash our clothes or take a shower, basically.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And you have to, in essence, reboot because you've shut your computer down. And so the secret of changing a child's behavior is to recognize the lockup and then step in to say, whoa, buddy, you're locking up. Tell me what's going on. And in the book, we go through 13 steps of, now you're not going to go through 13 steps every time, but it's the whole process of how you solve a problem. And parents don't really think that solving a problem is something that is their real opportunity to help a child. But we don't teach kids to solve problems early enough. And this starts at 2 or 3. I mean, the tantrums start at 18 months, and they should be gone by 3. If they're not, that's a red flag. You've got a child that is a not-so-easy child.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Bob Hudson, who is a retired pediatrician from the OUTU School of Community Medicine and author of the new book, The Normal But Not-So-Easy Child, Raising Your Child Without Frustration, Anger, or Guilt. And Dr. Bob, I wanted to talk a little bit about that because it's very interesting to know that by 3, you think tantrums should be at least developmentally gone if the kid is, I guess, being trained or learning how to solve problems on their own. But definitely we live in an era where I think too many parents, I would put myself in this category, are trying to solve too many of the problems for our kids so that we kind of make life easy for them. We don't want them to suffer. We don't want them to feel pain. We don't want them to be bored. And so we have various gradations of this. There's the helicopter parent. I've read more recently the lawnmower parent, where you're trying to just— The snowplow parent. You're just trying to literally pave the pathway for them. But that's just not real life. So you have some pretty good advice on this, including, I should add, at the end of the book, there are several appendices and tear-out sheets where both you can evaluate your child on a checklist or yourself as a parent. And there were some pretty funny gradations for to be a helicopter parent. I think the most extreme one was something like medevac helicopter, like you're ready for high emergency situations at drop of a trigger. Help us think through that formulation or why it's so important to let our kids make mistakes.
For about 40 years, I had a sign on my desk that says, "Do not handicap your children by making their life easy." And you really do, because life isn't easy. You're not going to be around. If they don't know how to solve the problems by themselves, they're at a distinct disadvantage. And we have a real crisis in our teens and 20-somethings because they don't know how to solve problems. The parents step in, or they pave the way, or they remove the obstacle so that this child again is happy. And we started worrying about happy in the late 80s and early 90s. Is your child happy? And happy is an end product. If you want to make your child happy, take them for an ice cream cone. If you want them to be happy, help them develop into a resilient adult.
Well, so you spend a little bit of time in the book on that, about the overwhelming number of choices that we all face as individuals. But for kids, it can be particularly overwhelming, even with two choices. And so the ice cream is as good an analogy as any. But you have a scenario in here where you paint, you know, you're trying to reward your kid, essentially. You take them out for ice cream, and the whole experience winds up turning into a mud hole, literally, or an ice cream hole for the family, because one parent just says, "All right, just make a choice. Just pick one." Yeah. And the other kid is more decisive, but then, you know, it doesn't work out.
And they change their mind at the last minute, and then they're in trouble. So I think it's how you teach a child to make choices, which is the first step in problem solving, is what are my choices? I had a parent once that asked me, "Well, how many choices should I give my child?" And I said, "How old is your child?" And they said, 4. And I said, "How old are you?" And she said, 40. And I said, "Well, your 4-year-old has 4 years of a data bank of experience, can barely learn how to solve problems now, and you've been through this for 40 years. So how many choices do you think you should be giving them?" And she says, "Well, I've been giving them way too many." And I think that the Brahms experience I had one summer was an example that you just mentioned, is that you walk up to this counter that's full of ice cream and you say, "What do you want?" And they're 5 years old. They need some help. So the first choice you give a child is, "Do you want to eat now or later?" And the next choice you want is, "Do you want this? This is what you had yesterday." And then later, do you want this or you want that? You know, they should be considerably older till they have sort of a smorgasbord choices of anything in the universe. And I think that that's one of the problems that we have. You know, "Oh, you've got to give the child choices." Well, no, you don't, because it overwhelms them. My granddaughter was sitting in a shopping cart at Target, and her older brother and her mother were helping her pick out a present for a birthday party. And one would say, "How about this?" And the other one would say, "How about this?" And finally, she was 3 years old. She threw her hands up, and she says, "Whoa, that's just way too many choices."
Pretty smart kid.
Yeah. And again, that's exactly how they feel. So you have to help them. You know, you don't just say, "What do you want?" In essence, to make them happy.
We talked a little bit about parents and helicopter parenting. Give us some strategies for how parents can be better at what we do or don't do. In other words, you talked about how when we as parents become angry, our IQ goes down 50 points and we fall into the mud hole with our child who may be having a meltdown or a tantrum. What are some strategies for avoiding falling into the anger trap? In the book, you talk about laying out consequences for behaviors or for expectations that aren't met. And of course, those are developmentally appropriate for certain ages. But, but take us through some of that if you can.
I think that one of the things we've lost in parenting is structure in the family and what to expect. The child gets up, and when I grew up, I knew exactly what to expect. I knew when I should be down to breakfast. I knew when and I should be dressed, and I should be ready to go out the door after I eat breakfast. And now the child gets up, and he whines a little. He didn't want to do this, and he wants to, you know, have his Cocoa Puffs and in his pajamas and watch television. And the parents, so many parents now leave home with heartburn before the day starts, because they really don't have it. I had a parent that came in. She had three kids, and she says, "My mornings are hell." But the children had no expectations. And I said, she says, "Well, I've got to do this, and I've got to do this, and I've got to." I said, "Why? Your kids are 11, 9, and 5. They're big enough to get themselves ready for breakfast. Why are you even in the bedroom area?" And she says, "Well, I just thought I should." Well, you shouldn't. They should be able to take care of themselves and get ready. So the morning expectation is, breakfast will be served at X time. I expect you to come down ready to eat. And she says, "But the five-year-old can't, you know, tie his shoes, and he can't quite." And she, I said, "He's got two older sibs. Why aren't they helping? When did we stop this sibs helping sibs? You know, I don't know what happened." But so she came back in a week, and she says, "I can't believe my morning." She says, "I finished my paper, and I'm having my second cup of coffee, and the kids come down all dressed, and they're so proud of themselves for doing it by themselves." And I said, "This isn't rocket science. Tell them what the expectations are. If they're not met, here are the consequences that will happen. And they're laid out beforehand. Then you don't have to rack your brain, what should I do after you've gotten angry? It's all there. You don't have to get angry."
So it's the win-win. I mean, so the kids feel great about themselves because they're actually accomplishing something. The mom feels fantastic because she's got her mornings back. And all along, she was in this sort of self-defeating mode of feeling like this obligation to have to do everything for the kids and enabling this sort of, you know, this continued. And it's not bad behavior. It's just.
And I'm a failure, and I feel guilty because it's not running smoothly. And yet, next door, that seems to be running smoothly. Well, they have easy children next door, and you tell them what to do, and they do it. Yours aren't that easy, but you have to do more. And I think it all changed in the 80s. In the 80s, women went back to work. Now, moms, don't get upset yet. Listen to what I say. It's not because you went to work. It's because when you came home, you felt guilty about being gone from your children. And then disciplining them or teaching them how to solve problems and being responsible for their actions was harder because you felt guilty. Guilt's destructive. Guilt doesn't help anything. And I think that that's when the structure began to slip. That's when the expectations began to slip. And I think that's when we really started getting into trouble. The good things happened. Dads got more involved, and that was a wonderful positive thing. But again, it's there needs to be structure. There needs to be expectations. There needs to be consequences. But they all need to be planned beforehand. Then everybody knows what to expect.
And so your tips for how to advise parents not to get emotional when they're trying to deal with outcomes, with behaviors, involve what? Is like having clear expectations, right?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is once you don't believe that their behavior is intentional and you don't expect your child to be perfect, they only learn by making mistakes. The three biggest things that you're the proudest of were all goof-ups to start with, and you overcame them. You solved the problem. That's why you're proud. You did it yourself. And I think that this sort of went by the by. But as soon as you start to understand my child's not misbehaving on purpose, they're having struggles with solving problems, and I need to help. And so you shift from being angry at them, because when you moralize good and bad, and the intention is good or bad, and you made bad choices, young man, then you're going to get angry. If you say, "Wow, they're really struggling, I need to help them," you switch to empathy. And all of a sudden, you're not angry. And so you're empathetic. You say, "How can I help?" And the first thing is what the problem is. Okay, what are your choices? And you go through the steps of what I call getting to now what. these kids get locked up and they don't know how to get to now what. That's not working, so now what? Telling them or yelling at them or getting angry at them just causes its own sets of problems.
And what are some other examples of taser words? Like you said, you know, come now or, you know.
Do it now.
Do it now.
Their brains just can't do now. And so if it's some kids can't do change, some kids don't do new. The really super shy child can't help it that they're shy and cautious. That's the way their brain's wired. They don't incorporate the new without, you know, learning that how to deal with it. Okay, now it's not new after having it around. You know, what most people do in today's world is that you introduce something new and they say they don't want it. So you put it up for a while and then you reintroduce it 3 months later. It's brand new again.
Right.
So again, it's that whole understanding. Some of it is their sensory threshold. If they're super sensitive and they're this one mom came in and she says, man, I understand my child and it's made life so much easier. This child was very sensitive. She was it's too tight or it's too hot or it's too cold or it's too smelly or, you know, all the senses were sort of overloaded, you know. And so once she understood that they can't help that, then, oh, I understand that this is a little too tight. Let's see what we can do. Maybe we can change this shirt for another shirt. Or maybe you don't like turtlenecks because they're always tight. So we'll give you your turtlenecks away and get, you know, sweaters that don't have a turtleneck. And it's little things like that that all of a sudden this one mom came in and she says, I have to tell you what happened this morning. She said, after I'd taken the children to school and I got home, my 9-year-old had left a note for me on the refrigerator that says, thanks, Mom, for being my friend again.
That's nice. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Robert Hudson, pediatrician and author of The Normal But Not So Easy Child, Raising Your Child Without Frustration, Anger, or Guilt, his new book just out. Dr. Hudson, I wanted to ask you about some of your research. You worked with a couple of school districts, I think, around Tulsa looking at temperament of children. Is that what you're trying to—
Yes, we looked at temperament and executive functions. Temperament traits are the components. They're sort of what the building blocks, and the executive functions are how those building blocks are used. And this really is a determining factor. And the premise in Broken Arrow was we looked at 1,100 pre-K students, and we said, okay, we think that we can predict who's going to have behavior and or learning problems at age 4 when they come in. And so we tested them all and followed them for a year, and sure enough, you really can. The testing early is something that is a simple thing to do. You can use screening tools that are really quick. And what we found in Broken Arrow was that in some classrooms, 10% of the students were not so easy, and others, in one of the classrooms, it was 55% that was not so easy. They do absolutely no screening to place them other than gender and birthday, neither one of which predicts whether you're not so easy or not.
Wait, that's interesting. So at the same grade level, one classroom only had 10% not so easy kids and another had 55% not so easy kids. So
right.
that you know, that classroom's going to struggle, right? Or that teacher's going to struggle.
Absolutely. And so one of the things that you hear from teachers that are experienced is, oh, boy, I'm so glad this year's class is, you know. And they just got lucky, but they could do a 1 minute. There's a not-so-easy scale in the back of the book that's a tear-out that in essence, in 1 minute, you can determine how not-so-easy your child is. Well, they could do that. The parents could do this for the school district, and they can look and say, okay, let's sort it so we spread out the not-so-easy kids. Or if it's really a progressive, then we do extra training, put an extra aide in the classroom, put all the not-so-easy kids in one classroom. And so then you really could help them with a program. Otherwise, you're just sort of spreading out the children that may or may not melt down at a whim.
And this might be more of a child development question, so it might not be fair, but I would assume, is there a socialization effect when you distribute the not-so-easy kids in a classroom that they're going to learn from their peers about how to problem solve, perhaps? I mean, it's one more avenue through which they could learn, right?
Yes. And if the teachers are trained, we did about 16 hours of teacher training with this, and a lot by the end of the year, a lot of the teachers were saying, "Well, I would say, well, how has it gone?" And, well, it's gone. I'm not having the problem now, But they knew how to address the lockup, recognize the lockup, address the lockup, and help the child solve the problem rather than and not put the class in a predicament. If 10% are non-adaptive. And you say, put up your pencils, we're going outside right now. All those kids are going to have a problem. Or at recess, it's time to come in without giving them any kind of a warning, without prepping them. And all classrooms should have a schedule of what's going to happen by every 10 or 15 minutes and then warn, okay, in about 5 minutes, we're going to change exercises and we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And all of a sudden, the classroom becomes calm.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the trajectory of your career. So you started, I think, in general pediatrics, right? There weren't as many subspecialties even when you started. But how did you evolve into this field of working on temperament and behavior? It's so interesting.
I think the physical part of pediatrics became fairly easy after 5 or 6 years. And the thing that really interested me was the questions they asked when I'd say, well, do you have any other questions? And you had your hand on the doorknob, and you never had enough time. And so I started identifying these. And then as a chief resident, I was fortunate enough to hear Stella Chess talk. Dr. Stella Chess and her husband, Dr. Alexander, are child psychiatrists, and they went into the nursery in 1957, and they categorized infants into 9 temperament categories.
Infants, we're talking about.
Infants.
Wow.
And they followed them then for 30 years, from 1957 to 1987. Temperament doesn't change much. And I was a senior resident in the late 60s, and she was making the rounds of some of the teaching hospitals and to say, this is where we are 10 years out. And it really looks promising. Temperament really doesn't change much. And so this was the first kind of, this is genetically passed down. These kids are hardwired from the start. And it was pretty exciting. And so that excited me. And so as I progressed through general pediatrics, I started making more and more time to deal with some of these kids, doing some testing. And then in 2002, I limited my practice to just behavioral pediatrics and saw parents that had children that were not easy.
And it grew by itself. I mean, you just had referrals from everywhere. People knew your reputation and knew what you were doing. And one good story begat another where someone would say, oh, you should go see Dr. Hudson because he helped me or our family or our kid or whatever.
I did a lot of school workshops, did a lot of teacher workshops. In fact, I got more referrals from the schools than I did from physicians at first because physicians don't really have time. And we're also trained to make a diagnosis. And in children under 10, the diagnoses are pretty sparse. They haven't been living long enough to get a diagnosis in mental health. And they don't know how to put what symptoms are important and to what degree are they important. And so, again, it becomes, let's see how they do. And that's how this, it's just a phase or they'll outgrow it started. But we now know with specific research they don't outgrow it.
Well, if you're a new parent, I can't recommend the book enough. If you're a current parent or even an old parent, there's a lot for you to learn here. You can certainly evaluate what kind of parent you are or perhaps were, although once you're a parent, you're always a parent. And you can certainly even look at your child and figure out more, probably learn more about your children through what kind of temperament that they have. The name of the book is The Normal But Not So Easy Child, Raising Your Child Without Frustration, Anger, or Guilt. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Robert Hudson. Dr. Hudson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Schumann.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.